Okay, as said, I have a relatively few slides. I'm not going to try to tell you all of what we do, but a little bit, and then I'm sure there's lots of questions, and that'll be fine. I'm sure you probably know this, but the principal legal requirement for drug approval, interestingly enough, given the way, say, Fidaja is at 280 pages, takes up less than half a page in the original, in the amendment that was written in 1962. So for effectiveness, there has to be what's described as substantial evidence that the drug will have the effect its representative is having when it's used as recommended in labeling. And then, since substantial is a term that doesn't actually mean a very high standard, it goes on to say that substantial evidence means evidence consisting of adequate and well-controlled clinical investigations, and the plural was plainly intended at the time, carried out by experts on the basis of which it could be concluded by such experts that the drug will have the effect it's represented to have. A court case sometime later determined that the experts who have to reach that conclusion is the secretary and us, although that was challenged at one point. And a law in 1997, the law was changed to say that one study plus confirmatory evidence could be enough to reach the conclusion that there was substantial evidence. You didn't always have to have two. The requirement for evidence of effectiveness, there was no requirement for effectiveness prior to 1962, and when we went back to look over the drugs that had been approved prior to 1962, putatively on the basis of a showing of safety, thousands of them turned out not to have any evidence of effectiveness. My favorite example was there were well over 50 treatments for alcoholism, all of which were barbiturates. I don't think anybody thinks that really works. The regulations go on to define what evidence of effectiveness is, and there's been tremendous attention to that question. So there's a regulation defining what a well-controlled study is. It says that, you know, you try to reduce bias by maybe blinding and randomization, and it describes five different kinds of well-controlled studies. Interestingly, one of which is a historical control. That means where you don't compare the two drugs in a randomized trial, but you give the drug to everybody and then compare their experience with what you would know would have happened to them without treatment. And in a recent analysis of orphan drug approvals by NORD, Frank Sasanowski looked at well over 100 of our approvals, and quite a substantial fraction of them are, in fact, based on such historically controlled trials. That's more credible where you know the course of the disease very well. So we've been encouraging people to try to collect as good natural history data as they can. You know, in the case of muscular dystrophy, you know, if you can make a convincing case that hardly anybody is stable for a year and a half, and then you find in your trial that people are stable, that's relatively convincing on historical grounds. So that kind of information can be very helpful. So in addition to our regulations, we have a massive number of guidances that tell people how to do things, guidance on statistical principles. Some of these are done under something called under the auspices of the International Conference on Harmonization, where mostly, at least initially, the Japanese, Europeans, and us get together and try to write guidance. So we write guidance on statistical principles, what kind of control groups are credible, including when historical controls can be credible. FDA has large numbers of guidances on many, many other things. We have one guidance in particular on what makes a single study credible enough to be the basis for approval, a very important matter following the 1997 FDAMA amendment that allowed us to rely on a single study. Not everybody agrees with what I'm about to say here, but in my opinion, the 62 amendment requiring evidence of effectiveness was the most important therapeutic advance probably in history. It moved the United States, and following our lead, the rest of the world, from a standard of medicine that was based on anecdote and rumor to real evidence. All of the things that we now take for granted, reduction in mortality due to hypertension and lipid abnormalities and things like that, atrial fibrillation, those are all based on well-controlled studies that documented that those things were true. Very important. It's moved over into, as appropriate, into testing of medical devices and a wide variety of things. There were just recently a huge trial of whether the Mediterranean diet made you better. That was a randomized trial done in Europe to test two different dietary interventions. For products and practices that aren't necessarily regulated, we sometimes get that kind of evidence because the world has moved to demand evidence, but sometimes we don't. My favorite negative example is the dietary supplement area, where things that might well be extremely effective are just rarely tested to see if they in fact are. A loss to everybody. Now, in various ways, despite the standard, the expectation that there will be evidence of effectiveness, our regulations and FDASIA emphasize strongly that the high standard needs to be interpreted with some sensibility, intelligence, and flexibility. And that's been stated in various regulations for a very long time. Back in the 80s, there's something called Subpart E, that's known to us as Section 312.80, talked a lot about how, given the huge variability of particular diseases and the kinds of things you have to prove, you've got to bring some intelligent flexibility to the evidence that's needed. It makes it very important. It also says that where there's no satisfactory treatment for a disease, while the statutory standard remains the same, it's critical that people use their heads and try to see how best to study it, whether smaller studies than usual will do the job. And as I said, what's been discovered for the orphan diseases is that much of the time only one study has been carried out, and much of the time it's in fact been a historically controlled trial. So all of this demands that we bring flexibility to applying the standards. FDA is required to exercise its scientific judgment to determine the kind and quantity of data and information an applicant must provide for a particular drug. That doesn't change the stated standard, but it says very clearly you're supposed to think about it hard. So what does all this flexibility mean? Let me give at least a few illustrations. Subpart E specifically urges that we have early consultation with sponsors to consider when the controlled phase two studies, that's the very first controlled studies that are done, can provide the basis for approval. If you can do that, you save years. Well, in certain areas, like in oncology, if a drug works very well, you rarely get past phase two at all. In fact, many cancer drugs are approved on what some people would even call a phase one study, where you take the drug, give 20 people who haven't responded to something else the drug, and you get an 80% response rate, and you're done. When the effects are dramatic, you can certainly do that. As I said, under FDAMA, as explained in the 1998 guidance, FDA can rely on a single, adequate, and well-controlled study. With other evidence, the evidence can be from other studies. The evidence could also be a profound understanding of the nature of the disease. If you restore the missing protein or something that causes a disease, that, along with a study that shows that it works, is a very persuasive set of evidence. And as I said, the NORD analysis showed that it's very common to use such data in the case of orphans. An additional form of flexibility is espoused in what's called Subpart H, fully endorsed by FDASIA as the accelerated approval provision. What it does is allow approval based on a surrogate endpoint. A surrogate endpoint is some measurement, a blood measurement or a pathological measurement or something like that, but doesn't have a direct clinical benefit, although you hope it'll lead to one, we can base approval on a surrogate endpoint that is considered reasonably likely, a judgment call, obviously, to predict an ultimate clinical benefit. This is very common in oncology, has also been used in other places and is increasingly being considered as we understand the genetic basis of many diseases. One issue that's very important to us, and it's highly relevant to muscular dystrophy, is that if we reach a conclusion that a particular drug that treats a particular kind of lesion is effective, what's needed for a similarly designed drug that treats a different deletion, something like that? Well, this has come up and has been discussed to a degree in cystic fibrosis, where there is an approved drug that treats one particular deletion or mutation called G551D and pretty much completely reverses cystic fibrosis. Well, people with that deletion are only 4% of the cystic fibrosis population, so the study that was done at 4% was able to find enough people to actually put in a trial, even though it was only 4% of the population. There are other mutations that might be not 4%, but 1%, a tenth of a percent, a hundredth of a percent. Is it possible that there's some way other than a clinical trial that would lead to approval of a drug like that? Well, one of the things you can look at is, in cystic fibrosis, you measure clinical benefit, how well the person breathes. You also measure sweat chloride, which is the sort of leading cause, leading lesion, as far as we know, that leads to cystic fibrosis. So it doesn't seem out of the question that perhaps with a little more experience, drugs for minor, smaller subsets of the population could be based on measurements of the surrogate, sweat chloride. And a similar kind of thinking plainly goes, could be applied to muscular dystrophy. But we'll see. We still have to get to actual approval first. There's always a fair amount of discussion of benefit and risk. The law is not very detailed on how much safety data you need. What an application has to contain is adequate tests by all methods reasonably applicable to show whether the drug is safe for its intended use. And those tests have to show that the drug isn't unsafe and provide sufficient data to allow a decision. But it's perfectly obvious, although the law never uses this term, that safety is invariably a risk-benefit consideration. We accept grossly toxic drugs that treat cancer and treat other things. Multiple sclerosis, probably the most effective drug for multiple sclerosis, kills about 1 in 1,000 of the people who get it. We've had meetings with patients, and they said, we'll take that risk because it works so much better than the other available therapies. And for many, many conditions, considerable toxicity is accepted in return for benefit. Some of my favorite examples, one good example is the drug clozapine, a very good antipsychotic drug. But there are lots of antipsychotic drugs. What clozapine was shown to do was work in people who'd failed on all the others. So the fact that it causes a 1.5% rate of agranulocytosis, which can be lethal, did not interfere with its approval. It's out there, and it's quite widely used because it brings something that's clearly worth it to anybody who has failed on other therapy. And there are many examples of a serious toxicity that's accepted in return for a benefit. When a disease has no treatment and is, you know, invariably lethal, considerable toxicity can be tolerated. I think it's very unlikely that for any neurologic diseases you can name, toxicity is going to get in the way of approval. I think that's very unlikely if the drug works. The subpart E, that's the part of the IND that I mentioned before, says very specifically that FDA shall recognize the need for a medical risk-benefit judgment in making the final decision on approvability and consider whether the benefits of the drug outweigh the known and potential risks and whether it's necessary to answer further questions. So not only does it say weigh how much risk you'll tolerate, it also says consider how much data you need. Maybe you don't need 3,000 patients for a bad disease. And in fact, if you go look at the orphan drug approvals, they have very, very small numbers as a rule. It also recognizes quite explicitly that patients and physicians are generally willing to accept greater risk or greater side effects from products that treat those bad diseases. I must say, I've never heard anybody doubt that case at work. So the safety databases for orphan drugs are often very small. We're talking in the 20s and 30s, and that's certainly true for many initial approvals of cancer drugs. Now, as we always say, and as I'm going to say now, I can't discuss anything about specific drugs. Some of the people who are hoping to market those drugs are here, and they can tell you anything they want, but I can't. And there are no approvals for drugs to refer to. But it's perfectly obvious from discussions that have gone around that apart from the question of whether the production of a Becker-type dystrophin will be an acceptable surrogate, not decided yet, I'm not telling you anything one way or the other, for initial approvals, we will certainly consider such issues, whatever we decide there, with respect to subsequent drugs for different genomic lesions, because success on a clinical endpoint might very well support that kind of surrogate endpoint. So that's something to keep in mind. It's important to recognize, and I thought the white paper didn't entirely make this clear, that accelerated approval is not a maneuver or a method to save a less than adequate clinical trial or convert a failed trial into a success. And I'm a little worried that the Putting Patients First paper sort of suggests that use of the data in its adaptive approval proposal. An accelerated approval is appropriate and is explicitly appropriate when there is a credible surrogate endpoint that people believe will correspond to a clinical outcome, and we all enormously value it for that. FIDASIA also opened up and expanded slightly on what we'd had before in our accelerated approval rule, on the possibility that a clinical benefit that was real but maybe not very impressive, wasn't clearly of enormous value to people, but clearly was a clinical benefit well documented, might be the basis for approval on condition that further studies elaborate on what the longer-term benefits might be. And everybody's perfectly happy with those. But at present, at least, for better or worse, there really is no adaptive approval provision for drugs in U.S. law, to the extent that adaptive approval means that the studies aren't well-controlled studies that support effectiveness but somehow become the basis for approval anyway. It's not that somebody couldn't think of a different system that would say for really bad diseases, the level of evidence could be lower. I mean, it could say that, but it doesn't. It doesn't. You can tell from what I said before that I don't think that would be a real service to people with bad diseases, but at the moment that it doesn't say that. Okay, a couple of other points. There is no one of the issues people have had is how big do the studies have to be and things like that. There is absolutely no required size for the studies intended to support effectiveness. As I said, for accelerated approval, for orphan drugs, the studies have often been extremely small. Many cancer drugs are approved initially on total databases of well under 100 people and sometimes well under 50. There is no particular reason to think that large-scale randomized trials are going to be required for approval if the drug, especially if a drug works very well. You don't need a large trial to establish effectiveness very, very convincingly, and it can be done. So we need to be quite clear on what risk-benefit really means. As noted, we've long recognized that people with untreatable illnesses will accept considerable risk. There's no problem with that. It's also possible that they might be willing to rely on less data, less than adequate data, but the law doesn't do that, and for reasons I've already explained, I'm sort of glad it doesn't. One more point. for various reasons, companies have fastened on the six-minute walk as the best measurement for effectiveness. That's not based on any advice or commands we've given. We think there's a variety of endpoints that might allow broader populations to enter the study. There's no reason why pulmonary status couldn't be a relevant endpoint, ability to climb a hill, all kinds of things. So we like the idea that people are that people are promoting a broader array of patients entering trials. There's also nothing that says that a company that's doing its major trial in one group of people can't have another trial in a different group that isn't eligible for the first. That other trial could be a control trial. It could be just observations to get more experience. There's considerable permission to do all of those things. There's no bar to it at all. Okay, so that's the end of my prepared stuff. And
why don't you open it for questions?
Yes. Any questions anybody has? Should. Do you want people to go to the microphone?
Yes. So we have microphones on either side.
Okay.
Thank you. That's a wonderful presentation. My question to you is the requirement of calling a surrogate a credible surrogate endpoint, and how do you define that, especially in relation to DMD, for example?
The law and our original rule said that the source of evidence for its credibility could be mechanistic information, could be epidemiologic information, could be any one of these kinds of information that makes it credible. And as you know from the question, there could be considerable judgment involved in that.
And the six-minute walk test, it's been approved for PAH, and there is a path forward, and I believe that one of the reasons that it could be utilized in this indication as well. For example, MRI could be used as a surrogate endpoint, but how much data would it be really required to validate that? It is one thing from a chronic disease that it's quite important to establish from a natural history study, if not a clinical trial, but in a short-term study, how would you validate that?
Well, past experience helps validate surrogates. Six-minute walk, by the way, just in case anybody doubts, that is not a surrogate. That's a clinical endpoint. It's an organized, standardized clinical endpoint. And other things that people are looking at, like climbing ability and their standard tests, the nine-hole test, which I don't quite understand, but I'm aware of it, those are all clinical endpoints. The surrogate would be fibers are now coated with dystrophin, and we think it's relevant dystrophin. We think it's Becker-like. Could that be a surrogate? And I'm not going to tell you the answer. There isn't any question that that may come up. There's no question also, this is what I said before, that if a drug that turns out to have a clear clinical benefit can have that clinical benefit correlated with the appearance on appropriate measurement, immunofluorescence or something like that, with dystrophin levels in the cells, that would help that become a surrogate endpoint for later use for different versions of the disease. That's one of the ways you learn about it. The difficulty is when you've never had a drug that worked, how do you get to a surrogate then? But you can, and we're going to be thinking about it, because diseases are better understood than they used to be.
Thank you.
That was excellent. It was over 20 years ago that they noticed that low levels of dystrophin delayed boys going into a wheelchair. It was Louise Nicholson in 1993 reported immunostaining of 30-odd Duchenne patients. 22 or so were making dystrophin detected by immunostaining and Western blotting. Now, on average, she said that the boys that were making some dystrophin went into a wheelchair 2 years later than those that were making no dystrophin whatsoever. Now, this is 20 years ago when you're looking really at the natural history of the disease. So therefore, how much dystrophin are you expecting to see before you can say it's going to be effective? Because here, when you've got some of the chemistries giving readily detectable amounts of dystrophin, the staining by Montoni was indicating that some of the fibres were 55% positive. There's readily detectable amounts of dystrophin with the morpholino at the moment. So how effective does effective have to be? Sorry, it's a very circular
that's
question.
That's the crucial question with any surrogate. How much effect on the surrogate do you have to have? Is getting to 5% of what's normal good enough, or does it have to be 30%? Trust me, the people developing drugs are all very mindful of that question. And the further question is, does the location matter? Does the appearance in a muscle biopsy? What's the best way to measure it? All of those things come up. And I can't give you the answers yet because that would conceivably predict what we are or not going to do, so I can't do that. But those are all the things you think about.
Because
all the time.
I'm a great fan of hypothesis-driven research. The whole basis of the exon skipping is to restore some Becker-like dystrophin expression. That's the hypothesis. You can show it by immunostaining. You can show it by Western blotting. So the amount of dystrophin has to be a really crucial marker. And if you can show 20, 30, 50% dystrophin, that's clearly going to be above the background levels of dystrophin, and it's going to have to be buying some time.
Well, more sounds better, for sure. I mean, the question for some of these, I don't know if that applies here. There are a lot of diseases where you replace the missing enzyme, blood factor, or something like that. One of the questions you always raise is whether it gets to the right place and does what it's supposed to do when it gets there. That may not be as big a problem here because it's sort of made in the muscle. Anyway, all of those things have to be considered. And the amount matters, how much it varies from one person to another. Could anybody show that improvement in outcome correlates with how high the levels go? I mean, all of those things add to the persuasiveness of a surrogate.
Okay.
So, thank you. Just want to clarify, it's not the dystrophin itself, right? It's the methods and by which the dystrophin is produced. If two different groups have both used dystrophin as a method, as a surrogate marker, but they have different ways of synthesizing, they could both, I mean, it's, you would judge that independently.
Well, they're not synthesizing it. They're having the body synthesize
it. Right. Inducing it.
Right. Well, it's a fair question. Could different mechanisms, different ways of restoring the deletion, or different deletions, lead to different levels of effectiveness of dystrophin? And then is the stuff you see on immunofluorescence really the Becker-type dystrophin that we hope it's going to be or not? I mean, it's hard to answer those questions.
So if somebody is trying to create more dystrophin using gene therapy versus exon skipping, even though they're both using dystrophin as a surrogate marker, they would be looked at independently. You would go through the hoops.
Yeah, I suppose some of the approaches would try to get ordinary conventional natural dystrophin, whereas some of them, as everybody here knows, try to get something that's closer to Becker's dystrophin. One of those might work better than the other. I don't know.
Thank you.
I just wanted to speak really quickly to the concern that you addressed about adaptive approvals. And I know you've heard this from me before, but as a parent, when we're all making individual decisions for our children, I think that we're as reliant on the science as you are, in essence. We're making the same decision on a micro level that you're making on a macro level. So I think we all here, because we've been forced to make those decisions for our children, have a really healthy respect for the science behind the decisions that we're making for our individual children. And I don't think that it's a desire to save studies or to kind of manipulate data as much as it is a confidence in the quality of the natural history data that's been collected and the predictability of the decline rate that leads us to believe that it's very supportive of using a natural history arm in comparison to the data much more so than wanting some sort of data manipulation, but that we have a healthy respect for it as well and have confidence in the type of natural history collection that's been done.
Well, my conversations have convinced me that people do indeed want something that really works. It's no favor to get something that doesn't. The current trials all have control groups. They don't. I'm not saying the natural history doesn't factor into your belief about the results, but they all do have control groups. They're of some kind. So the most obvious comparison is between the treated and the untreated patients.
Somebody needs a tissue. I just want to talk a little bit about the division, and there are some changes happening within the division in neurology, and I didn't know if you would be able to address the retirement of Dr. Katz and perhaps who's going to be overseeing. I know that there's some pretty important decisions right now at the FDA that has to do with some of the exon-skipping drugs, and as parents, you know, that's a concern for us. We don't want any delays if there's an approval or if there's more data needed, whatever it is. So as a community, we'd like to know what we can help, if there's anything we can do to help you with that transition. And as an agency, we'd like to know what you guys are doing to help everyone else through it.
Well, if you can, through persuasion or force, persuade Dr. Katz not to leave, that would be just fine. But we don't, I've tried that already, and it's not going to work. There are plenty of people in the division who are very conscious of this and watching over it. Frankly, there's plenty of people all the way to the top of the center who are interested in this and are going to be watching it. It will not lose attention. It's sort of very high on everybody's list of concerns. The current deputy director, Eric Bastings, will be the acting director. He's very competent also, and we're all nosing into everybody's business anyway. So I don't think there's going to be any gap. I really don't. And as I said, there's a very high level of interest from, Janet on down.
Thanks so much, Dr. Temple. I'm Dr. Brenda Wong, a clinician, and I would like to kind of understand a little bit about the rationale why the time function test, like the 10-meter walk time, cannot be used as a clinically meaningful endpoint for clinical trials for Duchenne's.
It can be. And I'm willing to bet some of the companies are already using it. The endpoint they choose has a lot to do with where they think success is most likely to occur. And there's a certain amount of guesswork until you actually do the study. For some of these, they may have an initial small study before they did their large study. That may have told them that one test works better than another. We're completely flexible. Any one of those would be perfectly fine if the drug was successful.
I've heard many times that the FDA would not accept the time function test like the 10-meter walk time. But clinically, that correlates really well, with meaningful endpoints like loss of ambulation and how we can predict with the time of...
It isn't true. We haven't told people one test is okay and another is not. We generally wouldn't.
That will be helpful.
What they do have to do is specify ahead of time they might do 5 or 6 tests, and they really have to identify which one they want to win on, and to calculate their appropriate p-value and all that. But we don't have a preference for which one to use.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I truly appreciate you being here. I've been in this business for 3 years, unfortunately, with my son, and I'm listening to your statements today and the slides, and they're all very heartwarming and encouraging. And I'm trying to reconcile that with, my perception that, it seems like sometimes maybe trials get stopped or drugs don't get approved for kind of like a point of etiquette or, hey, you missed the 6-meter walk by 0.8 meters, so go back to go, And for me, in the case of Adeloren, that 2 years it's going to take to recover from that 0.8 meters might be the difference between my son walking. So my question is not about Adeloren, but more so, can you help me reconcile how the flexibility looks so good up here, But in some trials, like a near miss is a whole miss, it seems. And as a parent, that has a huge, huge cost to me. Thank you.
Well, it's hard to talk about those things abstractly. I mean, we have, for better or worse, the standard for success in a trial has come to be a nominal p-value of 0.05 two-sided. That represents a level of evidence that people think means that the likelihood that it occurred by chance is low enough to be considered reasonable. There have been cases through the years where we've accepted a lower standard. One reason for accepting a lower standard might be that you are really sure you understand how the drug reverses the primary deficit in the course of the disease, and it has happened. It doesn't happen very often. When you're relying on a single study, the reluctance to do that is, if anything, even greater, because you don't want to approve a drug that doesn't work. There are a lot of ways that approving a drug that doesn't work is harmful to people. It means everybody's on that one, even when other ones come out, and no one will know which one really works, so people will get the wrong drug. It doesn't really serve the community very well. But we try not to turn things down because of trivial problems. I guess you're hinting a little bit that maybe if the effect size isn't as large as you wished it was, we turn it down. That's extremely unusual. There are some situations where people think an effect smaller than X is not meaningful. I don't think that's likely in any neurological setting that I can think of, and I can't think of any neurologic drug that we've turned down because the effect wasn't large enough, whether we're talking about epileptic drugs or anti-epileptic drugs or whatever. If you can show that there's a difference between the treated and the untreated people, the drugs virtually always get approved. But not if they're not statistically significant. That's true.
Your answer confuses me further. But out of respect and time, is, you know, looking at the charts and looking at your answers, to this lay person, it doesn't reconcile. But maybe I'll talk to you more afterwards, and I appreciate your time.
Okay, but maybe say more what you think was inconsistent.
Well, as I look at the charts and performance as a lay person, and you look at the variable in walking distance, you know, between the treated and untreated arm, to a parent, you know, with a engineering background, it seems relevant, and there's been, to my knowledge, no safety concerns. So I'm like, well, why wouldn't the FDA give you the benefit of the doubt? You know, not hope, it's not snake oil, but, you know, to even a layperson looking at it, there seems to be significant difference in the walking distance. And then you find out, well, no, you got to go do another trial. Well, that's time.
See, my trouble is I don't know the data you're talking about, so I don't really know
what
you saw. That no, that's what you don't. It's okay. I'm not supposed to. But you do. I mean, things like walking distance, for example, are quite variable. They change a lot. Two measurements on the same day will vary considerably. So you apply a statistical test to see if this group was really better than that group. And if you don't make the nominal statistical test, you've got a burden. And in most cases, we would not find that convincing, even if it leaned in a favorable direction. So
I'm confused. Who's responsible for setting up the measurement criteria in the first place, and who allowed to participate in these exon skipping trials? Because they all seem to discriminate against the non-ambulatory patient. And was asking, I was told, understood for years it was the FDA. You're saying that it's the researchers, the way they set up their...
You mean, say specifically, who's allowed to enter or what endpoint they
used? Who's allowed to enter? I mean... It's expanded a little bit to include anybody that's been in a wheelchair no more than 3 years.
Yeah, no, that is entirely their decision. Now, you can imagine, for example, that if someone's in a wheelchair, then they're not going to be able to use 6-minute walk, obviously. They're going to have to find some other measurement. And if those other measurements are more variable, more dependent on, you know, how you feel today, then it's going to be harder to show that the drug actually affects it. Companies choose endpoints, at least partly because they think they have properties that will allow you to win. One is reasonably consistent measurement. But we don't tell them which endpoint to pick. We don't mind if they look at several endpoints. They do have to order them so they have to say which one they're going to win on first.
So we need to pressure them to develop endpoints for, say, arms and other things than just the lower limbs.
Well, you also need to listen closely to their views about why they picked the endpoint they did, because they want a successful trial, maybe even not more than you do, but just as you do. And if they think that one particular endpoint has properties that make it easier to win, I mean, one of the things, if you did an exercise test and when you did it twice, it always came out exactly the same, that would be a very good endpoint to use because there's no noise. There's less variability. That's one of the main things you want in a clinical trial. You don't want it to go this way and that way. They're trying to pick endpoints that they think have properties like that. Now, whether they're right, whether there'd be a better endpoint, you know, I don't know enough to know. There may be people here who do. But I would say that even if they only wanted people who could walk 200 yards, that doesn't mean they couldn't do another study in people who are wheelchair-bound and with a different endpoint. Maybe they'll get lucky. But sometimes the companies don't have a whole lot of money, don't have a whole lot of drug, and they have to focus on it. I mean, those are all the realities of being a drug developer, which is not what I do. We just try to advise them.
And I have a broader question. There is so much of this exon skipping, and they're all, several of them are unique because it's different exons that you're skipping. So this is down the road. When the drugs are approved, is there an established distribution way of doing that to avoid clinicians from saying, well, it worked on this exon skipping, let's try it over here on this patient?
Well, that always raises an interesting question. We usually try to give good advice in the labeling, only shown to work for people with, you know, this property, and hope that most people will use the drug that way. I'm sure payers might try to influence the same thing. But a physician, in his or her wisdom, is allowed to give it a whack, even if it's not the group that it's known to work in, because if they don't have anything else, they might think it's worthwhile. If we were really worried that it might be harmful to the wrong people, we have various systems that more forcefully require people make sure the patient is appropriate. I don't know. If you want the drug I mentioned before, clozapine, you have to get a white count every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks. It varies depending on how long you've been on it. Because we really don't want anybody to get it if their white count is not being followed. It would kill them. We don't like that. And, you know, thalidomide requires a pregnancy test. So some things we actually insist on. Using a drug in a population that won't respond to it is not usually in that category. So we give labeling advice. We try to tell them who it's going to work in and usually hope that people will follow it.
Evelyn?
I have a question. It's sort of a combination question comment. But it's dawning on me as the recipient, as a patient of a medication for an off-label use that's been very effective for me personally, and also I'm a clinician, and I have some education by proxy in the pharmaceutical biotech industry. What strikes me about what happens and where that gap is between understanding the FDA's position, the pharmaceutical company's position, and the lay population's position is that most people that are working in the FDA who are looking at medications have clinical background experience. You have practice experience. The people who are designing studies in the pharmaceutical industries do not. And that makes a difference in terms of how you design methods to test something. So Duchenne's is a relatively new area for me, and I'm in women's health care, actually, and mental health. And what I keep hearing about is this 6-meter endpoint, and I'm thinking, yeah, but that's... And then what I'm hearing you say is, yes, that's one, but we, as the FDA, are not saying to the pharmaceutical company, that's the only endpoint that you can choose, but by the time it gets presented to you, that's the methodology with the endpoint that you're being given to evaluate. So would you say that's a fair assessment? Am I listening to you and understanding what you're saying?
We very commonly, for important drugs and diseases, have discussions with the company before they design the protocol. We don't know enough to tell them which endpoint to use, but one of the counsels that we give to people now is you should talk to the people with the disease to find out what the meaningful endpoint is. We strongly encourage that, not always successfully, I have to tell you. And they spend a lot of time talking with experts in the disease to try to figure out what the best measure is. So they may or may not be clinicians themselves, but they try very hard to get the best advice they can. And there, you know, in something like this, there isn't anything more important than figuring out what endpoint to use. So it first of all, it has to look like it's important or nobody will really care. Second, as I said, it should be an endpoint that you can measure reliably. You know, if you're interested in walking speed, there's more than one way to get an answer to that. You know, in heart failure, people do exercise tests. But that's not the only thing they do. They also use New York Heart Association classification, which is a measure of how well you get around. And there's a scale that was developed by NIH called the Living with Heart Failure Scale that sort of, in an organized way, tries to find out whether you can go to the store and walk up the stairs and all those things. All of those are possible. All of those are possible measures. And it's hard to know in advance which one's best. But one of the things that makes it best is if it's not too dependent on, you know, what kind of, whether it's a nice day, people's mood. You'd like to have something that is pretty solid and objective. And I think that's what they did with the 6-minute walk. Whether that's the right decision or not, you know, I'm not really in a position to say. We'll see. Also, without revealing anything, the companies are, at least some of them, using more than one measure. But I think I won't go any further on that.
Thanks, Dr. Temple. This morning it was announced that the FDA awarded breakthrough therapy designation to one of the exon 51 skipping programs. There's also another exon 51 skipping program under review. Presumably the agency has a lot more data than we do. There's a lot of data in the public domain. Just from a clinician's perspective, how good is the evidence in support of the efficacy of exon 51 skipping compounds?
I can't tell you that. It was obviously good enough that we granted breakthrough therapy to one of them. But the evidence that you need to support breakthrough therapy is short of the evidence you need to gain approval. It's defined in the law as preliminary evidence. And then, of course, you also don't necessarily know whether multiple people have applied for breakthrough therapy. I mean, you're not allowed to know any of that stuff. So you got to be very careful in interpreting any of these results.
So, Dr. Temple, I have a question. I think that what we've learned about the 6-minute walk test since it's the first industry-sponsored trial has been considerable. And then as we have learned, because the first industry-sponsored trial invited people who were ambulatory to and able, compliant with the 6-minute walk test. And then in the natural history data that we've learned over time, this window of where they're testing or accepting people in a trial has really been condensed into 250 to 400 meters, and we know that if kids are walking 350 meters when they enter a trial, it's likely that they'll walk for a period of time. So we're learning more about that. But my question isn't necessarily about that. But as we see this window of opportunity, for instance, shrink about participation in trials, what the parents are seeing of very little boys, and obviously non-ambulatory boys, they're not able to participate, right? So that's a problem right there, because in Duchenne there are no opportunities other than steroids, which is an opportunity and as well as certainly a risk. And so I guess there's several questions in this. One is, say that we, you and I, have this drug that we're looking at, and in the six-minute walk test and in that window, we're seeing a 30-meter difference, which at least to our interpretation says that the drug has some benefit. What, in your view, will the label likely to extrapolate and say that because we see this in this particular cohort, that the people whose mutation is amenable or the people who all have Duchenne are amenable? So will the label, in your view, be broad?
So you're particularly asking if you're only looking at people who are near to a point where they're going to have walking limitation, could the drug be used in people who are a few years younger than that?
Well, or very old, right?
Or very old. The labeling might well say where the experience is, but it's very hard for me to imagine that it would restrict it.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Very good to know. So then, as we see these trials come along, I'm thankful to know that you would feel that this would apply to all of them. Could you also?
I still have to discuss that with all my comrades. But if you think about the way antihypertensive drugs are labeled, the data may be in one population, but that doesn't say don't lower blood pressure in other people. Similarly for lipids. We don't restrict it, but we do say where the data are.
Right. But I'm asking because specifically in the non-ambulatory population, we found, at least looking at a variety of outcomes as recent as last week, that it's really, really hard to figure out the tests. There's a variety used, including usable workspace, including a variety of, as you know, the block testing and so on. But it is highly variable in the non-ambulatory population,
yeah.
And none of us would like to see a drug that couldn't be reimbursed for an older young adult. I don't know how to really
right.
say that, an adult
well,
with Duchenne.
Without promising, my bias is that when you're accumulating damage, you want to get there early.
Yes.
And if you look at what we're trying to get people to do in Alzheimer's disease, everybody knows that once you're a little bit demented, you're not going to make it go away, you're not going to reverse it. So what everybody's got in mind is trying to find people before they have any dementia, and we've just written guidance on how to do that. So there's a lot of interest in getting there in time to really stop it.
Well, I think all of us are really interested in getting early, and certainly prevention is much easier in medicine than ever trying to reverse something. But I think at the other side of this, the little boys are in need because of the fact that you could probably likely have a better outcome. But the older boys need every single muscle fiber left to them to be preserved to the greatest degree possible, even if that means being able to text their friends. And so I think we really need to have medicines for everybody across the spectrum. I worry sometimes that there will be at a certain moment, this isn't as effective as we would like.
Right.
But in speaking to the older men or the adults, fingers are quite
important. Well, what everybody would like to know is to have some measurement that's good for little kids, some measurement that's good for people who are wheelchair-bound or far along, and as well as some measurement that's good for the people who are intermediate. Whether we can get all that realistically, I don't know. But I would be very surprised if we tried to restrict it to the population that was
good.
Studied.
That's reassuring. So I have another question about that in sort of a similar frame of reference. Obviously, trials have to test a cohort of individuals that is most likely to demonstrate meaningful benefit, right? That's what you have to focus
on.
That's
what you want.
But in Europe, they have ATU programs where it's open to a wider population, based on a conditional approval, as you know. So I'm wondering, does it have to be the trial design? Because what we see in sort of companies are, obviously trying to gear in their trials to get to the answer as quickly as possible. But it's years, frankly, years to approval while younger and older patients wait. So Europe and other places have vehicles that enable the entire population or some more of the population to receive a drug. At the same time, the company to receive a reimbursement for the drug so that, as you know, some of these companies don't have operating power to consistently do it.
Right. Well, I haven't looked closely at the cases where they've done it, but as I understand their program, there is actually no requirement at all to get data to show that the drug really works. That's for them. That's a judgment they make. It wouldn't be mine.
Okay.
But I think the organizations like the people except here can really help get a large number of people into trials rapidly. It's not as though there's a dearth of patients.
Right.
It's not as though there's a lack of need. You know, some of the companies don't have a ton of money and all that, but there's no particular, I mean, if the trial needs to go a year or something like that, I mean, I would hope that you could enroll people so rapidly that you have them there right away. We know from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation that it's been enormously possible to facilitate the development of trials by having patients enter and be available, having their names. It's also very helpful on natural history. I mean, the more you know about the natural history, the more plausible it becomes to actually do a trial in at least some of these groups without needing a control group, if you really know that convincingly.
Well, we're seeing you on the 9th, and we're going to show you the natural history, so I'm hopeful that you'll be so impressed that you will agree that we just use the natural history as control.
Well, I don't think there's a bad case there. I mean, as far as I know, everybody who starts to decline continues to decline. Whether that's as documented as we like, I don't personally know. But if that's true, and you make things flatten, that could be persuasive.
Yeah, I think you'll be impressed with what they've learned in the last 3 years. Are there other questions? All right, well, I think we have to wrap up, and I can't thank all of you enough. Holly, John Bridges, Julie Ryan, and Dr. Temple, thank you for taking your time and coming here today. It really has been helpful.